Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Oh, hello. It's Thursday, and it's time to welcome you to Waypoints, where the Waypoint staff and friends take a break to nerd out and deep dive on the culture, art, and entertainment that's been inspiring and provoking us lately. Gathered around the table this Thursday, we've got Patrick Klepek.
Hello, hello.
And Danielle Riendo.
Who's ready for some basketball?
I am always ready for more basketball. That's not really true. I'm always ready for more football. There's going to be less football than there was a few weeks ago, given that the AAF apparently already folded.
Update on a previous waypoint. The AAF has been shut down three-fourths through its first season. It's gone. My Apollos, who did well, I don't know what their final record was. They were one of the better teams in the league, but they didn't even make it to the championship.
Well, there is no championship.
No.
What could be more American than a league that launches with not enough money to pay its employees for a complete first season and closes down when management's expectations and hopes are not met because there was no reason to suspect they would be. So farewell, AAF. You are a classically American morality tale. I have a lot of sympathy for players who competed in this. Yeah, and also I feel really bad for anyone who got injured playing in that league,
given where this all ended up.
That sucks. But Danielle, speaking of not even undercompensated athletes, but uncompensated athletes.
Yes, completely uncompensated.
Your waypoint this week is a really fascinating profile of a women's college basketball star named Sabrina Ionescu.
Yes.
And the article, Sabrina Ionescu is Always On, by Mirren Fader. Can you tell us a little bit about the article and who Sabrina Ionescu is and what sort of the thrust of this profile is?
Yeah. So I found it sort of looking at just general women's sports stuff, which occasionally I do as an interest of mine. I have not actually followed women's college basketball pretty much at all at any point in my life other than just generally enjoying the game of basketball. Like many of the things in my life about sports, it's sort of like, other than sports I've actually played, it's sort of like, oh, I'm just always kind of interested in the games and what's going on in them and all of that. And I found this really incredible profile. It's in Bleacher Report magazine about this really, really dominant player who just today I saw ESPNW kind of had her as number one in the, you know, upcoming WNBA draft. So she's really, really good. She has the record for triple doubles. And that's not just the women's record for triple doubles. That is, she has way more than the next, like, than the number one male college basketball player. And triple doubles, correct me if I'm wrong, again, not like a super basketball person, but that is, okay.
You're in a double digits.
Out of five statistics, out of five, like, major statistics, right? It's five or is it six?
It is, but almost always it's referring to three.
Okay.
That's the thing. Like, if you're posting triple doubles with, like, steals, like, if you're getting in double digits on steal, well, that probably means you're playing a really shitty team, honestly. Like, somebody was screwing up. Like,
gotcha.
You owned somebody completely in that game.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so by and large, it means double digits on points, double digits on assists, and double digits on rebounds. So it's, I guess it's kind of a good measure of, like, completeness as a player. Like,
what's
you weren't
the fifth one?
Blocks.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
steals also and blocks hard to, are like so also random. Hard to get double digits on that, especially with giant players, I think, being de-emphasized in basketball overall. But that is a wild stat for her and a wild accomplishment.
Yeah, really, really incredible. And I'm always interested. Sorry, guys, but I am always fascinated when a woman athlete has some sort of dominance over, like, even like the men in that particular sport. I'm always like, wow, what's she doing? What's she doing? Because that's not always necessarily the thing that you see every day. So it's always like, wow, oh my God, I need to know more about this person. It's a really great, both sort of somewhat classical sports profile, you know, sort of looking at the person, what they're like in conversation, what their basketball career has been like, and also a really fascinating sort of psychological portrait of a person who is almost pathologically driven. And one thing I do want to talk about, we can get further into this, because I know we're just kind of dipping our toe in at the top here, but just what this kind of says about the way we look at athletes and the way we sort of frame their success. And what it might mean in terms of at what point does an incredibly determined, incredibly successful athlete kind of push over into territory that is like a little bit terrifying and a little bit possibly unhealthy, because there are certain things about how much of a perfectionist she is, how much she is driven. The title of the piece reflects this, that she's always on, that she doesn't really get to relax and take a break. She doesn't feel like she can relax and take a break. She always needs to be kind of striving for perfection, not just success, but perfection. So that really kind of drew my eye to this piece.
Yeah, I would say that's probably like when I look at my notes, it was just like me growing increasingly uncomfortable with like the way she approaches the sport, her athleticism. And it's what for me was like trying to figure out, and I haven't read enough, I've always wanted to read more sports books because as much as I follow sports, I haven't read a lot of like in hindsight, like deep analysis. It's mostly just like the surface level stuff that is like in the moment. And really profiles on like people who succeed and why they think and like how much is why they think they succeed versus like why they actually do succeed. And like reading this profile, it's like hard. Like I find myself just like viscerally responding to this notion that you have to be perfect. You have to yell at your teammates. There's a whole side note. Like there's a whole lot of discourse happening now about like the like notion of yelling being like a useful way to like coach people up and whether that's just something people have gotten used to or if that is actually effective as a sort of like management technique. And I don't know, I kept going like, she seems amazing, but also I do not want to be around her, which is brought up in the piece as like sure. People had that reaction. And then I can't tell if they just became conditioned to being around her and doing well, or it's like a, you know, like you're a prisoner of her own making, but she's clearly an incredible athlete. And I guess I loved the way the profile delved so far into her personality. And the fact that I had that kind of reaction is both a reflection of like a really interesting person and a really well-written profile piece.
I think one of the interesting things, like to sort of understand where she's coming from, one of the things that's brought up right at the start is that there is nothing physically impressive about Askew as a player. Like, you know, we talked about other, you know, we were talking about like the NFL Combine, this emphasis on like, what's their wingspan? You know, like, let's measure the thighs on this dude. You know, stuff like that. Just like, and kind of these like, you want ridiculous like proportions, like incredible feats of strength, not in like the Festivus sense, but like in the, like, you know, yes. Bench press, you know, max out sense.
Or even the length of fingers.
Right. Yeah. Like hand size. Exactly. And Sabrina Ionescu is pretty average for a basketball player, even, you know, in women's basketball. She's not small, but she's not big. There's nothing particularly like physically dominant about her. And yet the results are, you know, again, like to refer to that triple double statistic, she is a dominant player and always has been. So what she has replaced like raw physical ability with here is raw mental ability and drive. And there were some things that were that were really cool. Like one of the details I loved is that she's a little bit of a basketball autodidact. Mm-hmm. And there's this description of there are two things about her that really like just were incredibly cool to think about. One is that when they teach most players to shoot, they're taught to like aim at the back of the rim. And that's the reference point when shooting. And she didn't have that training, so she just watches the ball as it sort of like leaves her hands. Like
she made it sound like she was self-taught, right?
Yeah,
that's kind of what my takeaway was. I mean, obviously, she's also had a
she had a coach since third grade, so she's like a little bit self-taught.
All right. Okay, yeah,
but,
fair.
But during that formative, she still does this really like idiosyncratic aiming technique. The other thing, though, and this kind of blew my mind, she knows how the ball moves and rotates based on who is shooting it. Like, she knows basically all these styles that her teammates use. And one of the reasons she's so dominant as like a rebounder is that she's not looking to see who is shooting or what the positioning is. She's just following the arc of the ball and its rotation. And she knows that, like, based on who shot that and the rotation, the ball usually like bounces off the backboard in this direction. So she knows where to position herself. And that is like a level of granular understanding, like ability to read a play that, to me, it looks like the ball like goes, you read the arc, and that's the end of the story. And there she is. Like,
you watch the NBA and it seems like, or WNBA, like high level play. It's mostly like players kind of looking at a basket and then going where physics going. And that made me want to ask you a question, Danielle, as someone who is far and away the most capital A athlete of anyone at Waypoint, is part of what I took away from this piece.
We're in my deep pants right now. I don't know if you can see.
See, there you go. Exactly. is reading this piece, that especially that paragraph that, you know, discusses how sort of like how unlike the typical type you'd expect for like an elite basketball player, and how much his profile spends illuminating the sort of like intelligence efficiency she has. For you, as someone that has participated a lot more in athletics, like thinking about that, like balance between like athletic IQ versus like athletic, you know, like strength, you know, I'm trying to articulate like the, but you know,
like
what I mean?
Raw, like, strength versus the intelligence and ability to kind of read patterns and execute on that super well. Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the things that hooked me the most, other than the sort of psychological element here, is just how fine detailed she is able to understand this game on. It does feel like she's operating, at least the case is made here in this piece, that she's kind of operating on the next level because of how much work she's put in, because of how much perfectionism and determination she has put in. She is actually able to read that next little bit. Like, I'm sure any great basketball player has some command of some of these things, right? I'm sure a great player who has played with another teammate for a very, very long time has some idea probably of the shooting style of their teammate versus somebody else. But she's able to read all of it like in an instant and able to actually really execute on that and make that next move based on that, which is frankly really exciting to think about as just like, oh, this is within the human capability to like understand this game on this level. It's also always cool to read about somebody who is not like necessarily, you know, the content warning, I suppose, for bodies here, but like this sort of genetic specimen that maybe certain Olympic athletes might be, where they have particular traits that actually do sort of, you know, make them a little bit better, give them that tiny little bit of an edge. She doesn't have any of that, and she's able to play this game at this level. And this is not a new game. You know, basketball's been played since, what, 1902? 1892. It's one of those years. I'm sure it's a while. This is a very well developed game.
Long
this is not
ass
new.
Time ago.
Yeah, this is not like a new sport where, you know, sometimes people who, again, MMA is somewhat in this region of like there are people there who have relatively average bodies that have just been worked to a particular degree and trained to a particular degree, versus sort of games that are older and you really know kind of where you might be able to go with that. I find this incredibly fun to kind of think about, just even in terms of my own sport and seeing somebody on a particular level able to like anticipate moves or anticipate like where the bone is in somebody else's arm to do like a perfect arm bar. Like, I was able to kind of translate this to that and I was like, oh my God, this is possible. And then we came to that other side of like, oh my God, it's possible, with a level of obsession that might be incredibly unhealthy and may indeed possibly hinder her in the future. It's possible she could hurt herself playing like this. That is sort of hinted at in the piece, where they basically have pitch rules for her. Like, you can't be on the court past this hour because you might actually hurt yourself doing this, you know, repetitive stress or this action that might be a repetitive stressor, which is really kind of damning to think about. Like, this level of obsession, this level of perfection could be damaging. It could be damaging to the people around her or her herself, right? Which is,
whew. Yeah, there are a few things about this aspect of it that I wanted to get into. I think before we get into any of this, I would actually like to start with a question. This is such an effective piece of sports writing, such an effective profile, that to a degree, I also wonder, and this all seems so familiar as a sort of persona. Like, if you ever read, there's this great article, I think it was a Michael Jordan at like 40 or something article, or Michael Jordan at 50, yes. Where it's talking about him dealing with the fact of his aging and his
retirement. This is where the anecdote comes, where he tries to like come back on the court and play because he's the owner of the
Charlotte Hornets.
Hornets.
Yeah.
And he goes on to try and like play with one of the players and like can put it together for like 5 minutes or something like that. I forget the full anecdote.
Right. No, like it was basically he was obsessed with regaining his playing weight. And also there were times he would try to practice like he would when he was a 25-year-old player and try to go as hard as he used to. And it just left him like physically devastated. But there's this point in the article where he talks about his drive and kind of acknowledges that while it was a gift in his later years now, he's finding it to be a curse because it doesn't go anywhere. Like where, like there used to be an outlet for this drive and intensity. Now there is not, but the drive and intensity is still there. And this article reminded me a lot of that, but at the same time, it reminded me so perfectly of these types of profile of sports stars that I also found myself wondering, is there just a little element of like, do we worry there might be a little bit of confirmation bias in this article? I expect this player to, I'm looking for what archetypes this player fits, and then we get a profile sort of demonstrating how she fits those archetypes. I think this was a conscientious and good piece of reporting. I want to be very clear.
Yeah.
But I also know that when you're writing stories like that, you do tend to look for through lines and narratives. And the thing I couldn't fully square is that on the one hand, she seemed so intense to the point of being very difficult to work with, but then also goes out of the way to show she's a great teammate. And I kind of wondered, is this maybe an oversimplified portrait of a person that emphasizes things we kind of expect to see emphasized with regard to like greatness and drive?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely a very valid both viewpoint and potentially like a, you know, kind of finding that there is a simplification in a lot of sports journalism, even great sports journalism, because one of the reasons we go to sports journalism or go to sports, I think, and, you know, correct me if I'm wrong or if this isn't true for other people, that's super fair. But we go to sports sometimes for simplified stories. We can see human excellence on a grand stage, at, you know, people who are so incredibly good at these, you know, really amazing physical actions. There is a simplicity in that there typically are winners and losers in that. And a lot of sports journalism does play into this. These ideas of archetypes, these ideas of sort of this is the grand stage on which this human drama is unfolding. And there are fairly simple outcomes, at least in terms of, you know, on the game level or on the season level or something like that. So I do think that's kind of a feature of this type of writing. I also think it is indicative of, you know, we might have a little bit of a determination fetish or fetishization in American, in the way we talk about sports. We talk about how hard fighters work, how hard athletes work, and we don't really talk much about the balance of that and how that relates to things like injury. If you work hard enough, and again, this is hinted at in the piece to some extent, but it's not really a major feature here. But it doesn't matter, even if you are the most sort of like naturally gifted athlete in the world or the most, you know, if you have Wolverine style super healing, you're going to hurt yourself if you never take a break, if you never take rest, if you never are able to kind of do that step back thing. And that's something that I think is a failing of us in a sports culture, the ability to only sort of fetishize that hard work and not actually say like, okay, a slightly more holistic approach says athletes do need rest days. They do need to chill out with their teammates sometimes probably and enjoy their teammate as a human being and not just a leader and not just somebody who's on all the time, which there are hints of that, but that's not really kind of the focus here, as you were saying.
I mean, like, yeah, the piece towards the end, the piece at the end, like, touches on a thing that I was hoping was just going to be halfway through the piece and instead was the end of the piece, which is it brings up, like, a moment, like, what because you naturally, the way this story is structured, like, Sona strives for perfection. They are always trying to get better. They demand the best out of everyone around them, and that when all else fails, they put it on their own back and then go out there and get the job done. And at the end, it's like, what does this a person like that do when they encounter failure? Now, granted, they're you know, their career is pretty young at this point. And so it's not surprising there's not like a huge amount of anecdotes there. But even the anecdote at the end that is about failure and how they dealt with it is sort of just brought up as like, well, of course, like they also did fine with failure and the sun came up the next day and like, but they're also still really driven. Like it was too bad that there, I would have loved to have seen like a whole section that like dug into what my guess is this person has encountered failure, setbacks in other ways that would have been illuminating for that type of mentality. Because I couldn't help but think, you know, reading this piece, then Rob, you bring up the notion of Michael Jordan. It is always fascinating to watch athletes at the height of their powers and then watch it come crashing down. Yeah. This happens most acutely in football, I think. I watch it the most, so I see it the most. But I can't help but remember the last two seasons of Peyton Manning's career. Now, Peyton Manning was an incredible quarterback for both the Indianapolis Colts, and then he finished his last couple of years in Denver on the Broncos because he had like four neck surgeries, and it was like largely believed he is never going to be able to play the game again. And he worked his way back and got picked up by the Broncos and had to a couple of seasons there. But what often happens with these quarterbacks is that they play until literally like they're playing in an all pro season, and then the next season they show up and they can't do anything. And this was so illustrated by the Broncos' back to back Super Bowl appearances, in which a couple of years back they went back to back. They got their ass kicked in one, and then they came back for Peyton Manning's final year. And the year before that, he was still a physical athlete. He was never the kind of guy that could run around, you know, and like elude someone that was chasing after him. But he had incredible physical gifts and also the highest, probably the highest IQ of a football quarterback that I have seen in my lifetime. One of the things he was able to do to illustrate that was like so gifted. You see Tom Brady do this a lot too. So gifted at going to the line and diagnosing what the defense is going to do, changing the play to both confuse the defense and set up his offense for success. So that when he came back for his final year, this is a man that was a stone block. He could not move. If the someone from the defense got through, he was going down. He was not going to be able to elude them. He would literally just topple over like a pile of bricks. Yeah. Because his body couldn't do anything. He also could not throw the ball downfield anymore. A huge part about throwing the ball in football is being able to throw it 40, 50 yards for big plays. And he could not throw it more than like 15 yards. And when the ball came out, rather than being like a crisp spiral so the player could catch it, it was this wobbly ass thing that like barely came out of his arm.
Yeah.
But he managed to help his team win the Super Bowl. Yes, on the back of an incredible all-time defense, but largely because he was so smart still. His football IQ still existed as his body failed him, and he was able to diagnose at the line and literally invent through mental acuity like ways of like getting his team down the field even though he could not throw a fucking pass. And so I thought about things like that as I watch this and as we talk about athletes who are engineered that sort of way in which they just go, 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 and literally the only thing that stops them is their body gives out. And then what do you do with the rest of your life? What do you do? You know, what do you do from there is a fascinating question.
Yeah.
There was something else here, though, that I was thinking a lot about, which is how we talk about how stars interact with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is the other part of this. On the one hand, the way they introduce the idea of like her playing with other people is to sort of talk about moments when she has a couple things she does. She will take control of a game. She'll be like, here, give me the clipboard, coach. I'm going to draw up a play because I need to take the game winning shot. But also will scream at players she thinks are not getting the job done, not working hard enough. Or she describes there. One incident is described where one of her teammates was just having a bad first half, was missing a lot of field goals. And Ionescu just screamed at her, you know, make a fucking shot. And the woman turned around and was like, I am trying. And the reply was, fuck trying, make it. And then,
very Yoda.
Then,
yeah.
Yeah. And then this other woman comes out second half, makes a bunch of shots. And it's like, yeah, you know, it's what I needed to hear. But it was interesting to see how there is a bit of discomfort with how Ionescu comes across at first, but then everyone is at pains to say, but she's also a really great teammate. She sends you supportive messages. She'll practice late with you. She's great. We love her. And maybe. But the other part of this is, in my experience, people remember being screamed at way longer than they remember, you know, a nice text message or like staying late at the office to like, you know, do extra work or staying late at the gym to take extra practice shots. And it reminded me a lot of and literally in the opening of this, one of Ionescu's favorite books is The Mamba Mindset, which I think is literally by Kobe Bryant. About how he plays the game. And there's a lot with Kobe. First of all, like, he is, like literally, he's a difficult person to talk about because he was very credibly accused of sexual assault.
Yes.
In addition to that, even if you allow yourself to set that aside about Kobe Bryant, which I think too much of the basketball world is eager and happy to do.
Yeah. Did you watch that farewell season of his?
God, no. Like, no. Yeah, all the farewell Kobe. Yeah, fuck that. Mm-hmm. It's disgraceful. It's still kind of disgraceful that he is still.
He won an Oscar.
Yes.
Or an Emmy?
Like last year.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Anyway.
Yeah, he's still in the mainstream.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really gross. And very revealing. But even if we just like take that away and just look at Kobe as a player, Kobe was a terrible teammate.
Yeah.
Like pretty much everywhere he went. Like he was a guy who sparked controversy in the locker room. And part of his philosophy was like somebody needs to provide that spark. Somebody needs to play that role of kind of being the provocateur and like holding people accountable. Being willing to scream at people. Jordan famously punched Steve Kerr, apparently, in practice, though Steve Kerr, I think, has later said that actually it was him who punched Jordan. But anyway.
yeah.
But I started thinking about this profile that Pablo Torre wrote of Jeremy Lin when he was playing with Kobe at the Lakers and talking about, like, one in the morning his phone buzzes. And it's Kobe being like, oh, I hope you're as pissed as I am about how this season is going. I was thinking about just how exhausting that must be to deal with. And it's really only an act that is even remotely tolerable if you are clearly the best person. When Kobe like started to like age and struggle, suddenly that act was a lot less effective and inspiring, right? Like he wasn't carrying games himself. He was being an asshole. And this was a thing that I kept sort of returning to as I read this profile of Ionescu. Like, to what degree are we soft pedaling maybe some of the more cruel aspects of her position as a teammate?
There's also a lot here that, and I'm glad you brought up Kobe Bryant, because something about this that did give me pause as well is the gender dynamics here of a woman athlete acting in this way versus a man athlete acting in this way. And I do think as a sports culture, or maybe certain parts of sports culture, are beginning to actually talk about toxic masculinity in sports, it is at least very beginning to be a conversation. But this is like a very, very sort of classic behavior of the alpha male, right? The like alpha male athlete who is like insanely great and he, you know, screams at everybody and he demands perfection. It seems to me like she has just sort of taken that wholesale. She's reading this book and she is sure acting like this. Now, they do certainly go out of their way to say that she is that she sort of adapts her style to what she thinks that teammate needs. Might not be her place to say what that teammate needs, but like the encouraging pat on the back versus the screaming at, they make the case that she goes one or the other. And I was a team captain in college, and I, you know, nobody will be surprised to hear that I didn't yell at people ever, but I certainly knew that some runners, you know, running up a really bad hill or having a really terrible day or running while feeling sick certainly needed something different for me on different days, or different athletes did need something different. I don't say that to excuse this because I don't think that her taking an aspect that could be seen as toxic masculinity wholesale and just bringing it into a woman's game is the answer either. I certainly don't think that's a good idea. I just want to sort of point that out in terms of how we talk about male athletes versus women athletes, if it's helpful at all, basically.
Well, I think it's certainly important.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it's certainly important, right? This is a thing where what do we make of a demanding star like this when it's a woman in women's basketball versus how does this come across in, you know, in a male athlete? Now, that being said, I do kind of think the discourse might be changing overall just in terms of expectations. Like, if you watch it, one of the things that Kyrie Irving has tried to do in Boston is he's tried to sort of play that role of taskmaster, you know, team asshole, and it hasn't gone over well.
Sure.
And he hasn't been able to carry it off because he's not like he's good, but he's not that like, yeah.
Sure.
Like a Jordan could back that up because a Jordan literally could take control of the team. So, so can Ionescu by all accounts. But if you're not able to throw the team on your back and get it done, I don't know.
Yeah.
Patrick, that's, you're going to say. Fair.
Well, I was going to say, it's also, we have a lack of models to even look to for leadership, right? Like, probably part of the reason she's reading books like this, why anyone would read books like this, you know, and we're all familiar with, you know, people in our own industry, like getting into management roles, and that's often no different than elite, you know, management and leadership are often, you know, one and the same or have a lot of crossovers. Like, how are you supposed to handle that stuff? People are often thrust into leadership roles by necessity, not by volunteer.
Sure.
And so once you're there, how do you find out the effective way forward? When, if you think about like the cyclical nature of all this, it's like, all right, well, the most successful ones have done it X, and then they are worshipped through books and sports reporting that enshrine Y, which often sands out like the harshest aspects of it, because we don't learn that stuff until decades later when people die or are more comfortable talking about the aspects that didn't fit the splashy profile at the time. And so you're left with flawed models to build around, in which you then can act flawed despite the fact that it's, what else are you supposed to do, right? And so I think that there is some aspect buried in this where it's like, when you have to become the lead, someone has to be the leader, right? Like, there has to be a point person for it to work. That there's a literal point guard in basketball. Yeah. When you're searching for answers, when we don't have like credible alternatives, like that is certainly a thing.
Yeah.
Either way, it's a really fascinating article, and definitely, I also don't follow women's basketball. But I am going to be really curious to see how Ionescu's story plays out, right? And I'm very curious, if she does go pro, I might actually start following wherever she goes in the WNBA, because I'm just very curious to see how this act plays when she's surrounded by a lot of women who've been similarly accomplished, right? And like, I'm very curious how this act looks when you're not the person who brought the Oregon Ducks you know, out of near irrelevance into, you know, the highest competition. So thank you. It was a great article. And I highly recommend checking it out over at the Bleacher Report. And I guess we'll have to see what happens with Ionescu across her career. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back with the rest of our show.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
All right, so Patrick, you said before the show you had a quick shout out. You've been listening to a podcast. We haven't talked about it to date, but you mentioned that the second season of the podcast "Justice in America" just came out and had sort of a fascinating conversation that you wanted to touch on, you know, on the show.
Yeah, I just briefly wanted to shout out, like, sort of as like the 2020 primary, you know, is well underway. I've, you know, I think like a lot of people spent a lot of flailing post 2016 to sort of like re-examine my own personal politics, take it as a time to like just thoroughly go through, what do I believe? Why do I believe it? What is the path forward? What if I was to reconceptualize how I think about various, you know, ideas I have held to be true or just not reconsidered over the years? And so, you know, we've shouted out a podcast like Citations Needed, which is like really, really good at like calling out bullshit. And I have found myself over and over, like, I really enjoy criticisms of systems, institutions, but also am now like really hungry for, if not answers, but just like conceptual ideas, ways of thinking, points of view that are about, well, okay, if we can't do A, what is the alternative? And so Justice in America is it's a two-season podcast so far. They just closed their second season, in which it's a episode-by-episode, really fascinating dissection of the criminal justice process. If you liked season three of Serial, like, this is a really, really good follow-up to that, to see like very in-depth understandings of different parts of the criminal arrangements and the process that we use to deal with criminality in society. And the last episode opens with, most of this podcast isn't necessarily about like solutions or paths to solutions. It's a lot of like understanding why things went wrong, what things are wrong. And they touch on like, how do we radically reconceptualize even what it means to speak about these topics? And one of those is like being a prison abolitionist, in which you literally conceive of what if we didn't have prisons, which is like a really difficult, like, it's that's a fun thought experiment, but then like, okay, well, what the fuck do we do with, like, you know, like, it's very, right. It's not neoliberal, it's not centrist to respond to that and go like, I literally can't conceive of that, because you have grown up with, and America has had, society has had that for all time. And so the episode brings on a prison abolitionist to talk through like, what does that mean? Both like practically near term, medium term, long term, what are ways we can get there? What are ways that places are already practicing the idea of society without prisons? And so I found it very useful to like have someone come on, talk through something that I would have originally had a response of like, I don't know how to conceptualize that. So what if we did something that was a little more pragmatic? And even if that's the way things actually end up going, I really, really appreciated the episode to like do a deep dive into like taking credibly and seriously something that you would ordinarily have like a response that is sort of like, I just don't know what that means. And so you get scared of it. And I came away like really enlightened and interested in reading more about it. And so just wanted to shout out that episode, that podcast. If you're like me looking for those types of things as we head into this part of the process of thinking of 2020, I found that podcast to be incredibly useful.
Nice.
Very cool.
I also, on that point, wanted to, if people have similar recommendations, like I would really like Citations Needed. One of the things they do really well is they break down centrist neoliberal policy and how much that overlaps with conservative foreign policy. It's really kind of one and the same. Like, there really isn't a whole lot of like different thinkings. And they poke holes in that and show the hypocrisy. But also, I don't hear a lot of discussion of like, what is like the leftist approach to reconceptualizing foreign policy? So people have like recommendations on stuff like that, like not just foreign policy, but just kind of across the board. They're like more specific ways to read up on not just what's wrong, but like, what is a different way of doing it and how we could do it? I'm curious to hear those recommendations. So
it's interesting, though, you framing it as like, as we head into 2020, because these are like, Paul, like, it's very interesting to me because a lot of these ideas are way outside the context of the election cycle. For mm-hmm. sure, right? Like, mm-hmm. prison abolition is a societal transformation level idea. Not, you know what right. I mean? A lot of people are talking about criminal justice reform, and I think I listened to a bit of the show and realized I didn't quite have the vocabulary to fully dig into it. I got a little bit lost in the restorative justice versus transformative justice.
Correct.
Like, there's when you're dealing with like high level ideas like this, there can be a little bit of jargon or discourse that you're not fully like caught up on, and it can make it a little bit formidable to get into. But it definitely seemed like these are ideas and. Our political process exists primarily in terms of incrementalism, and you know, how can we take the existing system and make it a little bit better? And ideas like this are really about completely rethinking how we achieve any sort of criminal justice? How would we even define
the word justice even mean?
Right.
Like a central tenet of like reconceptualizing a world like without prisons. And it's like, yes, ultimately the world then probably does operate in an incremental fashion, but like right now the arrow is being pointed in the incremental progression in a way that is not rethinking how we could do it. And so for me, it's like I'm trying to radically rethink my own position on those things and finding new ideas. So it's like, okay, yes, you can talk as though we're going to change society. And yes, the policy that is a little more pragmatic, it's a little more disappointing. But boy, if it's at least heading in a direction where we actually are rethinking things, like that's exciting and like I find it to be more personally interesting way to think about that stuff. And so I'm trying to think about, even though that's not necessarily what's going to happen, you know, day one of 2021, but I still find it to be like a useful exercise because often I find my own personal like fallback on pragmatism doesn't rethink what the end state is of that. And it's useful to rethink what the end state of that would be.
There's a wonderful cartoon that was put up in the kitchen at the ACLU where I used to work that was the sort of – it was just like a comical view of like what every different stakeholder sees a piece of policy as. And it starts with like a swing on a tree and it's like this is what the policy as – you know, as presented, as intended. And then, of course, it's like upside down when one other stakeholder looks like at it. The other one, the tree is upside down when another stakeholder looks at it. I'll share a link because I'm sure it's actually very popular, but it's like a very – I've always sort of thought of that whenever I've thought about policy discussions. And yeah, anything that gives more weight, more strength to what feels like a better, more progressive way of doing things in life tends to help at least somewhat.
So my waypoint this week is a bit off the beaten path for what this podcast has tended to be.
Is this a game?
Secretly just taking a Waypoint Radio topic and putting it into waypoints.
Well, and also a way to force people to look at the thing I want to talk about. Waypoint Radio is an interesting place because it's like, oh, here's what I'm playing this week. The discussion I really wanted to have about this required people to just like kind of look into this game a little bit more because I think it becomes more interesting if you can interrogate it a little bit.
Yeah.
So my waypoint this week is something I talked about on Waypoint Radio last week, I want to say, or maybe a couple weeks ago. It's The Occupation by White Paper Games. And as I said on that show, it is a game of – it is an immersive sim about political intrigue and conspiracy in an alternate universe like 1980s Britain. It's telling the story of you are a reporter investigating a terrorist attack that is being used to sort of ram through this combination Patriot Act / Brexit that's going to fundamentally transform society. And in the backdrop of this entire game, there's, you know, stories of massive protests and a government on the brink. And I kind of wanted to talk about this game's politics and the way it chooses to portray them and what it is really about. Because I think it's a really interesting game, but there's something about its portrayal of politics and what it's communicating and its use of setting that is sitting somewhat awkwardly with me. And I kind of want to talk a little bit about what we make of a game like this. Danielle, you got into it a little bit. I always sort of figured it would be up your alley as a sort of small scope immersive sim. But I'm curious what your take on was of this game and what you think it's trying to say.
Sure, absolutely. Well, first of all, I played quite a bit of it. I did not finish it, so I have to caveat that. I have looked at YouTube videos. I have sort of looked at things. And I did really enjoy it. But my core I completely hear what you're saying, and I also have the same feeling of, okay, I wish I had a complete understanding of what the Union Act really was. Clearly, it's an anti-immigrant act. In the game, I should frame this. The game is all about this sort of security center where they've developed both some software and also, I guess, where this piece of policy has been, you know, the brainchild of a couple of characters have creating the Union Act, which, again, yeah, it's sort of Brexit, also very Thatcher. esque, as you say, as well, and also very Patriot Act. Like it is very much sort of allowing for the spying on British citizens here, right? Like complete lack of privacy, getting rid of immigrants, lack of privacy. A whole bunch of things are kind of wrapped up in here, and they feel as if they're kind of picking and choosing from different eras of horrible conservative politics. And that for me was a little bit confusing, because I definitely kind of dug into a lot of the letters and emails, I guess, like IRC chat, that sort of thing, and was like, okay, but who are you talking about here? You know, and that is where any confusion I have with this politically kind of came from, because it does feel very much as if the writers of this game have something they want to say and they're fucking serious about it. And they went about it with a really cool, well-designed game. But the writing supports like 17 different readings and not necessarily in the way that I want it to support 17 different readings, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And that's like I played through it twice. I played through some levels several times.
Oh, wow.
And it was a bit like the more I played, the less certain I felt that I understood what the game was actually about. I think there's one way to frame this at the start, and it's an interesting decision, is that the occupation isn't really a mystery.
Right.
While the reporter doesn't know what's going on, the reporter you play for most of the game is investigating what is the Bowman Carson group really up to? What is the real story behind this bombing? The game literally opens with you playing a different character, Scarlett Carson, who is literally responsible for setting off this explosion. Like the first minutes of the game have you stinking around your office and like setting in motion the chain reaction that is going to kill 23 people in one of the Bowman Carson buildings. And so you see the crime at the start. And so that isn't really the mystery. Clearly, that's not what you're supposed to be in suspense about. That's not what is meant to be the most intriguing aspect of the occupation. But then that leaves the question, if the central framing device is, you know, what really happened here? But you already know the explosion, at least, has this different story. What are you meant to be uncovering in this game? And what is the occupation maybe saying in how it portrays the act of discovery and what it is that you're discovering?
Yeah. There's also a pretty... Help me work through this here, because I don't have a completely coherent opinion of it. But there is something here that seems interesting to me and slightly weird to me. I don't know if it worked for you, about the fact that you are a reporter, you are an investigator, you are a spy in a lot of ways, spying on the spies, you know, kind of like spying on this sort of secret software that is going to be the Patriot Act portion of this, which is interesting. And I think that works on one level as commentary. But it also, at the same time, it's looking at this sort of surveillance piece. And it's also looking at this sort of anti-immigrant piece. And that's, again, where I kind of had tension between, like, okay, these are both really good and valid forms of commentary. These are good and valid things to comment on. But I'm getting confused where one kind of leads into the other. And again, like I said, I didn't finish the game. So it might be wrapped up a little bit better by the end. I did watch most of a Let's Play. Okay, cool. All right.
I'm shaking my head vigorously if you're wondering why people are laughing.
Okay,
is,
cool.
Is some of this undermined? So I watched the first like 90 minutes, and then I watched one of the endings. Like, there's a choice. I guess there's a choice at the end. I'm not gonna spoil like what the choice is necessarily, but I wonder if how much, Rob, your understanding of where the game sort of like falters on, like, you know, what is it trying to say? What does it want to say? Is hinged on its framing and like the choice-driven nature of it, where like by its very nature it has to back off committing to A or B because it needs to give the player options. And it seems on a higher level to be a story about gray areas and perspectives, and maybe less about like coming down and like, yeah, but like that's the bad one, like that's the bad perspective.
Yeah.
That's a really good question. I think maybe it does get a little bit blurred in that you're right when you say this is a game about perspectives and I think the occupation ends up having a degree of empathy and sense of humanity for everyone involved.
Like, for example, like the one of the first major missions is you going to talk to like the PR head mm-hmm. for the group that is running the Union Act campaign. And she comes across as like very human, sensitive. She's not putting up a front, or if it is a front, it is a like very detached performance-based front. But like the way the character seems to be written, performed, is someone who's like, look, I'm trying to do the best with what I've got. We're trying to actually do the right thing by the country, and is not someone who is manipulating the facts to achieve an end in a deeply cynical, sinister sort of way. Now, those things may still be true by virtue of what they're doing, and like part of the exchange is you finding evidence that contradicts like the narrative that they're putting out to the masses. But even when confronted with some of that evidence, it's like, well, but I don't think you really. I mean, again, it's like all like this is just a person. Like the game is almost portraying this as a person who is flawed, who is trying to do the right thing. But geez, they just happen to be doing it in like a super racist way. And so I just found that to be like a really complicating factor in which I'm sure it is true that there are people who are participating in things like this that are more human than the like, you know, the mustache twirling in our heads or how they're portrayed on cable television. But maybe not nearly as much as this person. It seems like this game is assuming a little too much humanity and empathy on the part of the people that run these things. In a way that I had trouble buying, at least the part that I watched.
That is a great – I'm glad you pulled that because that is actually the one I was thinking of the most. So this is the other complicating part of this. There's a couple questioning sequences where if you have not collected evidence that directly contradicts what someone is telling you, then you can't pursue the line of questioning that sort of reveals that they're lying. Her interview in particular, she does come across as warm, doing her best, someone you can sympathize with, doesn't seem to have vicious intent. But one of the things you uncover is that it does appear that she's literally sitting on evidence that like could exonerate the person who's currently being scapegoated for this attack. There's this thing where one of the things being used to convict this guy is the fact that the ID card that was used the night of the explosion, his ID card, he claims he reported it missing. Somebody stole his ID. And there's no record of that. So if they're like, he's making that up after the fact, right? You discover that he reported it to this PR woman that mm-hmm. you interview, and she suppressed, like, she didn't pass that along. Like, the report went awry after it hit her inbox. And when you confront her with that, her response is, oh, gee, I guess I just forgot to log that. It must have hit my email after, and there's a lot of confusion. And you're left wondering, like, is she lying or, you know, I miss emails. Like, I guess that can happen.
There's a junk folder. And let me tell you, my Vice folder, my Vice email puts a lot of real emails in that fucking junk folder where I have a reminder each week on my phone that literally says, check the junk folder. You probably have the code for the game that you're wondering that you want to play in there.
And this is maybe part of the thing is that maybe this is one of the things that muddies the waters here. Is that the game is so interested in portraying the humanity of these people, and the thing you discover is just the little office dramas and gossip. They're all just everyday people that I'm not sure this game recognizes that sometimes stories have a fucking villain.
Yeah.
That there are people – that like there are some people who do want to inflict harm on other people. There are like people who choose policies that are harmful – not because they are well-meaning and confused, but because literally they want to stick it to somebody. They have prejudices they are trying to exercise. And that interview is a perfect example of even if you catch her red-handed in lie after lie, you can still come out of that meeting being like, man, I guess everyone here is just, you know, doing their best in a confusing time.
What's so interesting about that particular interview, I had the telephone records that she, even when you sort of show her again, the suspect in the bombing was actually calling from another location, which sort of helps to prove his innocence. But she sat on that too. And if you show it to her, she's just kind of like, I don't know. Like, she's just such a master of spin, which is hilarious because, of course, she's either completely incompetent or great at PR, which is her job. So that's nice. But there is a lot that feels like commentary. It feels like commentary.
I like Danielle. Doesn't, you know, just want to say, you're great.
Just ethered the entire PR profession. I'm sorry, our PR friends who are listening. I didn't realize that Danielle was going to leap off the turnbuckle.
I apologize. And
that was great. I loved it. I mean, but anyway,
in this case, she's, it's not great because this is PR for a horrible racist policy rather than PR for a game or whatever. Okay. Anyway, moving right along, there's a lot of this, and this supports that this sort of idea of like just how mundane so much evil is. And I always appreciate that in games because games do have that sort of twirling mustache villain kind of ethos a lot of the time, or the villain that tells you that, you know, you're not so different, you and I. So this was something I actually sort of appreciated in the game, was like, you know, the sort of really charming interactions you can have with the guards and the guard who wants to be an actor and things like this that are like really very charming and really like fun and nice to see. And then you step back for a second and you say, and they also work for this racist, horrible policy. And they all kind of got caught up in it in some way, whether or not they actually, whether the security guard has anything to really do with this policy, they are still working for these people, right? They are still in this really complicated web of what human beings do, what we all have to do to work and survive and all that sort of thing. Maybe I'm reading too far into it, but I do always sort of appreciate that when a game does this with, oh, evil's really mundane most of the time. Most of the time it is paperwork and crappy voicemails and things like that. It's just it happens to be for this racist policy as opposed to, you know, whatever grandiose thing.
Does the game understand that, though? Or is it just that, well, it's an immersive sim, so we need, like, a janitor and we need, like, a carrot. You know what I mean? Like, I, on some level, it seems like this game doesn't understand, like, the rhetorical bullshit artists that are the people that run, like, campaigns like this. And then, like, the kind of person that would be running comms for the Union Act would be more of a Kellyanne Conway and not someone who just, like, becomes fucking human when you, like, disarm them with, like, one piece of evidence. Right. No, you move on to the next thing and you spin the bullshit. Like, the reason people like Jordan Peterson, Ben Shapiro, Milo is, like, they're extremely good at talking. They never give an inch and they always push back. And that's been the – if this is a game playing on the story of the last, you know, 4 years or so – if your takeaway is that like, well, if you were just to scratch away the veneer a little bit, like they're just people under there. Like, that's not my takeaway from these people. And it's not my takeaway for how these people would act if confronted in this manner either.
So,
and granted, this is all from this one conversation. So I don't know where the game goes from here or if I'm overstating its interpretation of politics.
I think so. The game sort of knows it. I think, for instance, there are literally conversations. The janitor, for instance, you overhear talking to one of the security guards at one point. Basically, they're debating this entire anti-immigrant turn in the country's politics. And the janitor is basically articulating this very old-fashioned view of, you know, the way we do things where I'm from, the way I was raised, is if you're in our community, you're in our community. And as long as you're, you know, a good sort of person, you know, help out your neighbor, do your job, you belong here. And that's as simple as it is. And he's like, if we're going to start saying who belongs here and who doesn't, you know, who has the right to make that determination. So the game does have some of these less empowered characters articulate some of this perspective. I think it's also interesting that Bowman Carson is – it's very like a halt and catch fire type era of technology. Like,
sure.
It's also a tech company where people are really high on the technology, the problems they're solving. And the game does know that people can become mesmerized by what their technology can do and not really consider what it is being used to do. So, for instance, you find like the programmers in between like creating the database that will run this massive index of persons living within alternate universe UK. they're also getting in trouble because they're running a LAN party on company grounds. And it's a good period detail, and it's a funny touch, right? Like, it's literally like people screwing around on company equipment and using the internal network to play Doom. And in the backdrop of this, that company equipment is actually there to index people for rounding up and deportation. But the game doesn't – I think maybe the game could stand to be maybe a little blunter with this. And I do think it has trouble recognizing that there are bad actors. One of the people who's most directly involved in some of the violence of the policy that you interview turns out to be also one of the most ambivalent characters you meet and comes across as almost ashamed and embarrassed by – aspects of what they do. But that means that this is a game that there's almost almost nobody you meet seems to really believe the thing they're trying to do is good or that it is in their interest to do it. And I think that is a problem because I think it is a blind alley to always assume that self-interest always points everyone in the same direction. And the only thing that leads us astray is misunderstanding what our self-interest is.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was wondering how much maybe for the two of you that are, so deeper to immersive sims than I am, I wonder how much of this is like a flaw or intrinsic to the design of these sorts of games in which you are always supposed to find layers upon layers upon layers of information. And so it's like, oh, I open this one, shelf and I find this one piece of information. I find this other, the reward structure for an immersive sim runs not necessarily, but can perhaps lead you to run counter to like more authored direct rhetorical writing because of the nature of how you're trying to unfurl it for the player. And like, that's what you're here for. This is how you're supposed to explore and learn about the game. And so, especially when you're dealing with like topics of politics and especially like modern ones where there should be like pretty clear takeaways, especially given what the game seems to be setting up for. Like, I wonder if it falls into a trap of not being as declarative as it should be by the very nature of its design.
In sort of trying to work through that question, I sort of did a little baby thought experiment of like, if I was somehow able to create a game out of my office, for example, and actually go into everybody's email and actually go through every piece of information on everybody's computer and, do the immersive sim thing in some sort of real life setting with the amount of information that's there, it would probably be pretty hard to come out with any kind of distinct through lines, right? And maybe we could find a couple that sort of made sense. But so much of the real world is information overload, right? And we're sort of trained in certain ways to look for particular pieces of information. And in an immersive sim, it's closer to that than most other games where you'll have one email and that only has one narrative purpose, right? Of like, okay, I read the email and now I go to A to B to C to D. Whereas in something like this, you're still looking at objects. You're still sort of able to look at all this sort of information on the periphery. But I do think you need to be careful when you're making this type of game to be very intentional with everything that you're writing and be very intentional with what the meaning of any given object is. I think it's I don't want to say failure here because I do really like the game. I do think it does some things extremely well. But the fact that I think we are having some confusion about some of its viewpoints and some cloudiness and some fogginess here, it is possibly on the writers more so than the designers, in my opinion here. In terms of what you're doing mechanically, it's a fairly stripped down immersive sim. So it's not as if I am sort of authoring a wild experience where, my character in Prey figured out her way through the entire station using the glue gun, and that's all she did. You know what I mean? Like that story that I wrote in terms of like what my character did versus this is entirely a game about sneaking around and hacking into emails and using floppy disks and things like that. So, yeah, I do think this is actually on the writing more so than it is on like the type of game. I guess that was a long way of getting there, but yeah.
No, I agree. I think if you look at a lot of other immersive sims, they do use a little more blunt force in getting their point across. Like Dishonored, there are cool things to explore, but in general, what you'll find is that every piece of correspondence almost always relates either directly to the plot and gives you a sense of where people stand in relation to that, or there's a full vignette that is uncovered in one space that like has a, like you basically know what happened here and it's clear. This is a lot of ambiguous office talk and people just living their lives. And when they are getting their job done, they're setting up an authoritarian nativist police state, but they don't really identify. They don't identify clear through lines with that. I do think what I do put on designers is it should not be anywhere near as hard as it is in this game to unpack all of what is going on.
Sure.
Like I ended up playing levels way more than I actually wanted to because I just needed more time to explore and find what the hell is going on and actually listen to audio tapes and figure that stuff out. So I think that is – they made it hard to access the complete picture they're trying to paint. And I think that is another – that is an unforced error in terms of – This is kind of an intricate story with a lot of nuance, but then you also put everything on a clock that doesn't give you a lot of time to appreciate the nuance and sort of meditate on it. So it is a complicated story that literally doesn't give you time to read it. And that, I think, is another area where the occupation kind of stumbles. I don't know. I would like a patch at some point to come out and be like, you know, easy mode, we got rid of the timer.
Hell yeah.
Story mode.
Easy mode.
Yeah. Yeah, especially, like, that's the weird thing. I always did feel like this game almost like has this horror of turning into Everyone's Gone to the Rapture, where literally you just walk through scene after scene and see a tableau. But their solution was, you know, what if tiny office alien isolation? with harmless little Steve wandering around as the alien.
I really enjoyed that one encounter. Like I was scrubbing through a Let's Play trying to get to like the major points, and it's like at some point the player tries to break into like a clearly some place where there's evidence locked away, and then they're like, hey, like you're not supposed to be here, but you know what? I'm gonna give you the benefit of the doubt. And then like that's the game's way of like warning you, like you better sneak in better. I was like, that's extremely, it's extremely funny, which made me laugh quite a bit.
If they framed you as not a, you know, white dude reporter, maybe we could have had a little bit of commentary here in terms of the game.
I think the game's whole relationship with race is actually interesting because a lot of the people, like, it is a nativist government policy that's being put into practice, but only against, like, the only victims you hear about are, like, French people, which is, and then a lot of the people at Bowman Carson, it's a very inclusive game. There is one worker who is, you know, hard of hearing and communicates via sign language. A number of characters are people of color, which is good. But again, if you're literally making a game about like nativist policy, that is rarely just about one's immigration status where like, oh, it's just, you know, doesn't matter if you're white. We just want to make sure your paperwork is in order and you belong here. There's almost always an element of like racism built around like your religion or the color of your skin. And this game kind of sidesteps that. And I understand why you might want to sidestep that. Like you want to present it just in the purest, most abstract form of what a policy like this would be. But it does leave you in a weird place where, you know, you have a racist policy in a game that models a society without racism. And that ends up being a slightly strange place for the game to wind up. Just an aside here, you know, we're running a bit long. I also just thought it was strange that with the 1980s setting, clearly there are elements of the Thatcher period trying to be evoked here. And again, though, the politics are completely removed from Thatcherism, which is almost entirely about like economics and about breaking leftist organizations and breaking up worker power and favoring corporations and privatization. There's a lot of that. And it's very strange because the game is trying to, is sort of capturing the tumult of 1980s UK politics, but nothing that actually made them tumultuous, which I think is a bit odd.
Yeah. I kind of wish they would have picked, it's not that they could only pick one thread, but if they kind of stuck with one and maybe had some supporting detail from others, I think it would have really helped some of this go down in terms of being just not as confusing about what the voice is and about what it's saying. It is a little bizarre that they didn't just go with the Thatcherism, given that this is the time period for that. And you could do plenty of things with the war on the poor that you are also kind of trying to do with the war on immigrants and on, you know, completely dismantling privacy rights. So this is, again, I wonder if it's something of a problem, just guessing here, but I do wonder if it was just kind of a bit off more than they could chew thematically and narratively here for how tight of a game this is and ended up being, which is not a it's not a complaint to say that the game is tight and a fairly, you know, reasonable length in terms of playtime. But for how much content is here story-wise and how many kind of like really dense political threads they're pulling at, it may have been better to kind of focus on one here.
Yeah, I think when you are using a combination of political moments and then aesthetic from a different period, you need to have space to explore what you're doing. Otherwise, pastiche can end up becoming camouflage for whatever point you're trying to make. And I think that's where the occupation kind of ends up. It's frustrating because I think this has been one of the most interesting games I played. This is why I made it a waypoint. Like, I think it's a really fascinating game. I think its politics are interesting, even if they're not clear. Like, I think it is a flaw that its politics are not clear because it means the story that it tells, I still don't exactly know what story I'm meant to draw. Like, what is the through line? What am I supposed to draw from this? But I don't think that completely overshadowed for me the degree to which this was a cool concept and in a lot of ways was pretty well executed. They bit off more than they can chew, but it was a good bite.
Yeah. I agree. It was a good bite. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a cool direction for the immersive sim to go. And again, I do ultimately recommend The Occupation. And if you do pick it up, I'm very curious what your readings are on the game, and if you know a bit more about the period that it is set in, and maybe there's things that it is evoking that would be clear to somebody who lived through 1980s Britain or 1990s Britain that maybe we're missing here. So I'd definitely be keen to hear about stuff like that. Anyway, I think that will be it for today's show. Our thanks to Tumelo for the track Slide Asleep off the album After Midnight. You can find that at tumelomakes.bandcamp.com. You can keep up with all of us at waypoint.vice.com. I'm Rob Zachney. You can find me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. Patrick, where can people find you?
At Patrick Klopik.
Danielle.
At Danielle R.I.
And that will do it for this week's Waypoints. We hope you've enjoyed the break. Please be sure to rate and review us on your podcast platform of choice, if it allows such a thing. I think we're a 5-star cast, but really it's up for you to discover.
We're in the triple doubles, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Like, just breaking records all the time. True, mostly on length and lack of discipline. But nevertheless, records are being broken. We'll be back again with Waypoint Radio on Friday. You should also be sure and listen to Be Good and Rewatch It, where this week, Austin and I ended up getting sidetracked into... We had to put Pride and Prejudice on break for 1 week. And we ended up getting sidetracked into another Jane Austen adaptation, 2009's BBC adaptation of Emma, starring Johnny Lee Miller and Romola Garai, which was really, really good and made for a very good discussion. So I hope you'll join us for that and join us again next week for another episode of Waypoints. But until then, do not give in to astonishment.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Perfect.
Yay, great pod. That was super fun, yeah, guys.
That was a good one.
That was great.
I enjoyed that.
That was an extremely good pod.
Good meaty pod. And also fun.
And it was only an hour 15.
See? Tight.
We can do it by accident.
Nice.
Kato, you're laughing a little too hard at that.
Yes.
Austin, I fucked up bad yesterday is all I'm going to say.
Oh, we no. How long did you go?
We got onto a bit that turned out not to be a bit.
Rob, all I asked was for a time code.
I couldn't tell you, but Kato, I'm sure, knows to the second.
Kato?
Hold on.
3 hours?
Oh, he's got a screenshot.
2 hours, 49 minutes, and 24 seconds.
Yeah, wow. That sounds about right.
Wow. Good.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Very good.
Oh. And that's cut down.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, that's the edit.
They haven't laid us off yet. Give them time.
Not yet.
God. All right.
They'll lay us off and like, what were they doing here again?
When you go through the emails, someone go
excavate this and come back with a report.
God.
Why is this room so sweaty? All right.
All right. See
bye
ya.
Guys.
All right. Take care, gang.
Bye. Honestly, Electric Wine, not the worst name for like a like early 2000s like video game blog. I'm trying to get noticed. Hear my takes. Come follow my takes at Electric Wine.
Tevis.
Still a good name for a white supremacist free social media platform.
God. Correct.
All right.
Extremely correct.
Let me get my recording going. I've got my recording going. You're recording, Patrick. You're recording?
Yeah, I just started.
All right, cool. On 26.
Oh, sure. Hold on. Oh. No. Not on the website. Wait, I can do it. We should do it again. But I just wanted to. I made it, but we should
you
do it again.
Did make-
All right, 38.
Like, I got there, and, like, the page was, like, caching and loading, and the seconds were going by really fast, but I was like, I'm jumping in. I got it.
No, I love hurry-up offense. Hell
yeah.
All right, here we go.